It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. This election season, private companies like Lyft, Patagonia, and Walmart are taking steps to make voting more accessible, which begs the question, why don't Americans vote? Are there systemic barriers that keep people from the polls on election day? We'll talk about what those barriers might be and if anything can be done about them. Do you find it difficult to vote? Why? Have you ever missed out on an election for factors outside of your control? And what were they? Does your employer allow you to vote during the workday? How does transportation factor in to whether you make it to the polling place or not? And do registration requirements or voter ID laws keep you from the polls? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas.wpr.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. All great ways to get in touch this morning. David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also a member of the Elections Research Center on campus. David, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Let's start with the basics. What is voter turnout like in the United States?
So it varies a lot from presidential to midterm years. So in presidential years, it averages around 55%, which is exactly what it was in 2016, a little bit lower in some years, a little bit higher in some years. In 2008, it was more around 58, 59%. Midterm years, it ranges from a low of 33% in the last midterm in 2014. That was the lowest it had been since World War II. To as high as around 40%. So, generally 20 points lower in the midterm than the presidential years.
And what about Wisconsin specifically? How do we do?
Wisconsin is usually up in the top two or three in the country. And so the last midterm election, when the nation hit that 50-year low of 33%, we were actually at 54%, so 20 points higher than the national average and second in the nation in turnout. So it's states like Maine and Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, we're usually in the top two to four in the country.
But still, 54%, when you think about it, we would assume why wouldn't we get like 80, 90%? Why don't more people vote? Do you know any idea how the United States compares with other the industrialized or developed nations in the world in terms of election turnout?
Yeah, real not very well. So, in fact, we rank 26th out of 32 of the OECD countries, which is the Western developed countries. So, towards the bottom, about fifth of those countries. So, countries like Belgium, Sweden, Denmark, they have turnout of over 80%. Belgium was 87.2%. Sweden 82%. Denmark 80% in their last elections. And so there are two big differences that explain this higher level of turnout in other countries. In some countries, like Belgium, it's actually compulsory to vote. Now, in most countries that have mandatory voting, they don't actually enforce the fines. Usually it's a fairly small fine if you don't vote, and it's rarely enforced. But I think just having that idea that it's mandatory to vote clearly makes people turn out at a higher rate. Then the other thing is that almost every other industrialized Western country that votes on Sunday rather than a weekday. And that seems to also have the effect of driving turnout up a bit.
So of the people that don't vote here in America and in Wisconsin, do we have data on why that is?
Yeah, so basically all we can do is ask people, and you never know for sure if they're just giving an excuse or what, but sometimes we can at least get a sense of why people don't vote. And in the polls, typically the most common reason given is just people say they're too busy or conflicting work schedule or school schedule, and that's usually about a fifth to a sixth of the electorate says that. Now, in 2016, we saw a reason that was the first time this reason was the most often expressed, and that was that you didn't like the candidates or campaign issues. And a quarter of the people who didn't vote said that was the problem, which isn't surprising given that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were the two most disliked candidates that we had ever nominated for running for president. And so that was the main reason keeping people from voting in 2016. And then the other reasons given, people sometimes say they feel like their vote won't matter, they're just not interested in politics. And so, the typical kind of responses you'd expect from disengaged citizens.
Let's talk about some barriers to voting. Recently, we had a conversation where on this program where we talked about how people in the disabled community can have find barriers at the polls. But there are other barriers that can affect anyone, transportation being one of them. What does the transportation barrier look like, for example, in urban areas versus rural areas of Wisconsin?
Well, right. You definitely have a problem in both urban and rural areas with sometimes the voting precincts are not close to public transportation, so people don't have cars, and urban areas have a very difficult time getting to the polls. And sometimes in rural areas as well, there'll be one central voting precinct for a area where the population is widely dispersed over that that rural area, and so it is hard for people to get to the polls. Now, there are different organizations that have tried to provide free transportation, but that's obviously pretty difficult to coordinate, and that doesn't happen in a lot of places. Then in other cases, you have a situation where the state itself is trying to disenfranchise voters in exactly this way. There's a high-profile case right now in Dodge City, Kansas, that's a Latino-majority city. They have a single polling place for 27,000 people, and they just moved the polling place out of town, and it's at least a mile away from public transportation. So this was like a concerted effort to try to keep people from voting in that competitive state where they have a very competitive Senate race going on in this election.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also a member of the Elections Research Center on campus. We're talking about why we don't vote. The illustration you gave in Kansas, that's not the only place this kind of thing has been happening. We've heard stories in various states where polling places were shut down or moved voting machines weren't up to speed, that kind of thing. All of these things together can keep people from voting and maybe discourage them from even trying. Do we have any data on that?
Yeah, no, it's a big problem. And Georgia right now is one of the biggest offenders in this regard. They a while ago, there was a high-profile case where they tried to shut down many precincts in heavily African-American areas of the state, and with the sort of excuse that they weren't ADA compliant. That's why they said, and these were, again, mostly rural areas, very high African-American population, and they were just closing these voting places where people would have to drive miles and to be able to go vote. And there was a court injunction to stop them from doing that. But then there's another effort that is underway there right now where the state is holding up 53,000 different voter registration cards for people right now whose voting rights would be, they wouldn't be able to vote in the election because it's not a perfect match between what their name says on their voter registration, what it says on their driver's license or other state record. And sometimes it could be something like a middle initial being missing in one version of the name or the other, or a hyphen being missing. So truly trivial differences that could be preventing as many as 53,000 people from voting. And 70% of those people are African-American in Georgia. So clearly this is a targeted effort in that state to try to keep some people from voting.
There does seem to be a lot of paperwork that comes along with voting. There's registering and then in some cases re-registering, voter IDs, changing polling places. There seems to also be a lot of misinformation about voting procedures floating around. And does that keep people from the polls as well?
Well, I think voter confusion does have some impact. And my colleague Ken Mayer had a study of this in Milwaukee and in Dane County from the last election. And Professor Mayer showed that there indeed were thousands of voters who were prevented from voting or didn't vote anyway because of misinformation. And they thought they didn't have the proper ID to vote, when in fact they did. And so all of the, the different accounts in the media sometimes are not sufficient to break through that fog of misinformation that many voters have. And that, again, we do have evidence that does keep some people from showing up at the polls.
So where can listeners go to find accurate information?
Well, the Dane County Clerk site has all the information about voting, of where to go. You can go to the My Vote website. Also, we'll give you the information on what kind of documentation you need to vote and where to go vote. But basically, it's pretty simple. That Wisconsin actually is one of the best states in the country in terms of making it relatively easy to vote. And that's one reason that we always do rank in the top three or four in the country in turnout. We're one of the handful of states in the country that still has Election Day registration. So you can actually go to your voting place on Election Day, and there's a separate line. You have to register first. Wait in that line to register to vote if you're not registered already, and then the separate line for voting. But it makes it very easy for voters who have forgotten to register, whereas in many other states, there's a 30-day window that if you don't register 30 days before the election, you're out of luck. And so we're actually fortunate in Wisconsin to have that Election Day registration.
We're talking about why people don't vote. Wondering what you think about this. Why, if you don't vote, why don't you vote? What keeps you from voting? And if you do vote, what barriers have you experienced getting to the polls, being able to vote, that kind of thing? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. David Cannon, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a member of the Elections Research Center on campus, stays with us as our conversation continues. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. This election season, private companies like Lyft, Patagonia, Walmart, and others are taking steps to make voting more accessible, which begs the question, why don't Americans vote? Are there systemic barriers that keep people from the polls on Election Day? We're talking about what those might be and what might be done about them. Do you find it difficult to vote? Have you ever missed out on an election because of factors outside your control? And what were they? Does your employer allow you to vote during the workday? And how does transportation factor into whether you make it to a polling place or not? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a member of the Elections Research Center on campus. We have some phone calls here. Let's go to Baraboo. Rick is with us. Rick and Baraboo, I want line two. There we go. Rick and Baraboo, go ahead.
Yep. Hi there. How are you?
Great. Go ahead.
Good. I recently lost my wallet, and I found out that here in the state of Wisconsin, because there's been so many cutbacks to the local DMVs, that getting my driver's license renewed or a new one was a major hurdle. The area around my home or where I work, they're only open on Wednesdays, and those hours are like 9 until 3. So I actually had to take time off from work to get my driver's license done. And then with voting on Tuesdays, and I work construction and I'm on the road, we're working 10-hour days. It's pretty much almost impossible. Either we have to take a day off or a half day off, or my boss says, hey, find one of the other workers to replace you. Mm. So, it's definitely a bad deal, and our current governor has made it harder for the average person.
Rick, thanks for that call. David Cannon?
Yeah, Rick makes a really important point, and something that those of us who live in Madison or a larger city really often don't realize, and that is that in the rural areas, sometimes the DMV offices are open, as Rick said, only like one day a week or sometimes one day every other week for limited hours. And so while under state law, an employer has to give you 3 hours of unpaid leave to go vote on Election Day, that's required by law. So that's an important thing for our listeners to know, is that your employer has to give you time off to work to go vote on Election Day. But they're not required to give you time to go, get a new driver's license. And if it happens to be those 6 hours while you're working, like in Rick's case, know, then it really is a burden on voters. And so this is an important limitation on people's ability to get that access to voting, is needing to have that voter ID and how difficult it is to get that ID in some parts of the state.
If Rick lost his wallet, so he's probably in the system as being someone with a valid driver's license, would he be able to cast a provisional ballot and then prove who he is later?
Yes, you always can do that. If you are on the voter rolls, but you don't have the proper ID when you show up, you can cast that provisional ballot and then provide evidence of that later. But you have to do it pretty quickly after the election. And so, again, Rick would probably still have to take time off work or someone, you know, in his situation to go get that ID shortly after the election. But yes, provisional ballot is always possible to do, but then you do have to follow up to prove that you actually have the proper identification.
Most polling places open around 7 in the morning, and they're supposed to be open until at least 8. Some stay open until 9. For some folks who are working full-time, getting kids to and from daycare, doing anything else, working like Rick, our caller, that window of time might not be enough. And as you mentioned, our employers are required to give people time off to go vote, but they don't get paid for that. What about countries that make Election Day a national holiday, meaning you don't have to work? Do they see a higher turnout?
Yeah, so there are not too many countries that actually have national holidays. I think Singapore, South Korea, there are, you know, a handful of them that do. But as we mentioned before, the very typical thing to do is to have elections on Sunday. And in most countries, you know, there are fewer people anyway who have to work on Sunday than during the week. And so that does seem to have a very positive impact on turnout, is having voting on a Sunday.
Do you see that becoming an option for the United States?
Well, there's talk about it every now and then, and people do bring up also the idea of a national holiday for voting, but it's never gotten a lot of traction. And for whatever reason, we seem to be stuck to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And it could be changed, though. It's nothing, you know, in the Constitution that has to be on that day, so it could be
how
changed.
How did we get to that whole first Tuesday after the first Monday thing anyway?
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine some people sitting around in a room saying, gosh, when should we vote? Oh, I know.
Right. I know. I have no idea, Don. I've never heard the story on how that actually got picked to be the precise day, but it's arbitrary, and it definitely could be changed.
So what about the fact that the election day is just that, one day? Would extending the voting period help?
Well, it does. And in fact, we do have a lot of states now that have early voting. And in fact, in the 2016 elections, over a third of the American population, 34.5%, voted early, either in person or absentee. So about 47 million people, with 24 million by mail, about 23 million voting in person early. And so that, you know, definitely makes it more convenient for voters. Now, research has shown that you need to combine that with same-day registration to really boost the turnout. If it's just early voting, it's more convenient than actually stimulating turnout in a meaningful way. But it does help to have that easier access by having early voting, which, by the way, we do have in Wisconsin. It varies from community to community of how accessible that is. But here in Madison, you can go to any library right now during the opening hours and vote early up until November 2nd.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and a member of the Elections Research Center on campus. What barriers to voting come up in urban areas of Wisconsin?
Well, one of the big ones is just lack of access to public transportation, but also voter ID laws have had a disproportionate impact on urban populations because it has a disproportionate impact on minority voters and also on college students, because college students now, the college regular college ID for most campuses in the state don't work to vote. You have to get a special ID that has a date on it showing you're an enrolled student. And so it also disproportionately affects the college students.
It's safe to say that some Americans don't think their vote counts. So how big a problem is that, and where do those feelings come from?
Yeah, no, that is something you see regularly in the polls. It's about, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15% of the people say that they don't vote because they don't think their vote will count. The meaning typically given to that reason had been that people felt like, oh, well, so many people are voting, my vote couldn't possibly be pivotal if there are, you know, more than a million people voting. My vote doesn't matter. Just in that literal sense, like, you wouldn't change the outcome of the election to show up. In some mathematical sense, that's true. But if everyone thought that way, then nobody would vote. And so that's, you know, never, to me, been a very compelling reason to vote. But now there's some evidence also that some people who are giving that answer on surveys are worried that for voter security reasons, like, you know, your election, that's going to, databases will be hacked and your vote will be changed, and that's why your vote won't count. And there is increasing concern right now over election security, and there's no doubt that we need some substantial work to beef up the security of our election systems. But that, again, is not a reason not to vote. We just need to improve the security of our elections. And in Wisconsin, again, we have a very secure system because it's so decentralized.
All right. David Cannon, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Okay, good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a member of the Elections Research Center on campus. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Maria Idrisi has been described as the face of a generation. In 2015, she became the first hijab-wearing fashion model to be featured in a global campaign. She has used her fame to become the voice of her community and a leading authority on the concept of modest fashion. She's also been front and center supporting many humanitarian causes and women's empowerment generally. Maria, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning.
So what was the public reaction to seeing you in an H&M advertisement?
It was a very mixed response. So within the Muslim community, it was mixed because some people were really for it and super excited. And then obviously some more conservative Muslims were calling me things like a sign of Judgment Day, and they weren't so happy. And then again, mixed from non-Muslims as well, where you had the more open-minded ones who were, of course, really happy to see the progression. And then some people who said I was a representation of ISIS or something like that.
So pretty much mixed reaction all around.
Yes.
Either like or you don't. It's not really a lot of neutral responses. It was either for you or against you, sort of.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
How did that change, that experience change your life?
Oh, my God. It changed. Well, first of all, I had to quit my day job because it was so manic. I had a choice. Either I can go full force, do all the interviews, the press, the talks, but that means I have to leave my job. Or I could just say that was fun and just go back to my regular life again. So that was probably the first major decision that I had to make. I always say I don't believe you trust in God until you become self-employed, because that is when you truly understand, like, okay, I have to make use of what I have right now, and just, yeah, trust another being. So that was definitely the biggest choice.
What was your regular job at the time?
I was managing a children's shop. So I just finished university, and I was looking for like a career to work in film. So I wanted to get into script writing, filmmaking. And then literally a couple months after graduating, that's when I got scouted. So I was like, okay, well, I guess this is my new life.
Wow. Why do you think representation in fashion is important?
Oh, it's so important. Representation for me is one example of empowerment. It is empowering to see someone who you can relate to being seen in a positive way. And especially in this day of age where you had so much negative representation of my community, there was nothing kind of to balance that out even, let alone just for it to all be seen as good. So it is so important now.
Did you ever think that you'd become a spokeswoman for diversity in fashion?
No. Not at all. I had no idea.
Well, how does it feel to be the de facto person that has to speak for so many people?
It's okay, because obviously I feel like I'm comfortable with it and I have that confidence to do it. But at the same time, I don't represent every Muslim woman, because within ourselves, we're so diverse too. So it is important for there to be loads of different voices and opinions as well.
How can society support diversity and inclusion without tokenizing people?
Well, we are slowly moving, I think, in the right direction. There was a rough start to all of this, but it's all about collaboration. That's how I feel the best way to work with people and to include everyone is by actually working with them. And that's where we have to have some more improvement in that, because a lot of people want to attract and market to our community, but then they're not working with people to do that. So then a lot of the time they get it wrong the first time, and that kind of puts us off.
Well, let's talk about the role of the fashion industry in social movements. How do you see the fashion industry fitting in here?
In social movements?
Yeah.
Yeah, majorly, because fashion, it's so visual, and it speaks so many different languages to everyone. It's religionless, cultureless. It's just for everyone. Anyone can be a part of this whole fashion movement, because we all need it. We all wear clothes. You know, it's something that's compulsory to everyone in their lives. And again, yeah, it's just images. So it's all kind of displayed through art. And I think that's relatable to everyone.
Maria Andreessy became the first hijab-wearing fashion model to be featured in a global campaign back in 2015. In your in a recent TED Talk, you say that often during interviews, people will comment on how wonderful it is to have a hijab-wearing woman represented in fashion. And then right after that, they'll ask you why you feel you must wear it, assuming it's a symbol of oppression. What's your response to people who think that?
I'm happier that they ask the question than don't ask at all, because obviously, if you've grown up in a town where you haven't ever met or come across a Muslim before in your life, I don't expect people to have those kind of answers, especially when the only thing that's shoved down their throats is negative around the whole hijab and Muslim women. So for me, this is my way of liberation. This is my expression of liberation, because I have made the choice to wear a hijab. No one in my family, aside from my mum, actually wears a hijab. And that in itself, just my personal story, I feel was an example of liberation and self-expression. So I think it's good that people do ask those questions so that we can answer them.
Do you feel like you've helped open the door for other hijab-wearing models?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just me alone. This is definitely it's a collective of us. The whole modest fashion movement has been going on way before the H&M campaign. But I think it was just post that where it really came to life. A lot of it was kind of in its own bubble, so it existed, but the mainstream hadn't picked up on it yet. So that's definitely made an impact.
Well, let's talk about the concept of modest fashion. For those who don't know, please explain what it is.
It's so subjective. It's modest fashion to everyone could mean something different based on where you're from. For me, I wear the hijab, which is a religious obligation that I choose to wear, and I mean, I know it sounds on the contrary like a religious obligation, but at the end of the day, we all have that freedom as to whether we want to adhere to it or not. So I choose to wear the hijab. And so modest fashion then connects to my faith as a Muslim woman who wears a hijab. But for someone else who's not necessarily a believing woman in any faith, she could still choose to dress modest just because of personal choice.
Well, what impact do you think you've had in terms of awareness of the idea of modest fashion?
I like to think there's been a lot of impact. I'm here in America, so it is a big thing when you're able to be able to travel and tell your story to so many different parts of the world and meet so many different people. So I think, yeah, there's definitely been an impact.
Well, what does it feel like to have that responsibility to be kind of the face and voice for the concept of modest fashion?
It's a good responsibility, because it's me being myself. I'm not putting on an act. I'm not, you know, it's not like something that I have part-time job with and then I have my other life. Like, this is me all round. So I'm just happy that I can be myself entirely in my career, in my personal life. So, yeah.
So let's talk about your humanitarian work. You work with Human Care Syria. Explain their women's hygiene and sanitation project.
So Human Care Syria, they're a charity specifically targeted at Syrian people. And one of the campaigns they had was for women's sanitation, which is basically encouraging people to understand that when there are these kind of situations that happen in war-torn countries, that it's not just about keeping people alive. They're human beings just like us. And a lot of Syrian people, they lived very, very similar lifestyles to us. Syria was not a deprived country. And for them to go from thriving to literally just trying to survive, we're encouraging people that women need basic necessities that we take for granted: toothpaste, toothbrushes, sanitary towels, you know, all sorts of things that are just simple and basic, but they don't actually have access to them. And that's what the whole campaign is about.
This week you have speaking engagements at a pair of University of Wisconsin schools here in Wisconsin, UW Stevens Point and UW Oshkosh. Mm-hmm. How has your experience been in Wisconsin? How have people here responded to your story?
Really positively. I came here last year as well. So everyone's like, oh my God, you've been to Wisconsin twice? And I'm like, yeah.
And on purpose you've been to Wisconsin twice.
Exactly, yeah. I've probably seen more of the state than a lot of people that live here. And you know what? I've had a positive experience both times. I've never had any issues. People are really friendly. So as much as there is this kind of idea that, oh, Wisconsin's very white and, you know, they're very conservative, it's like, yeah, they are, but I've had positive experiences both times.
What's next for Maria Idrisi? What are you planning to do next?
My whole movement right now, aside from Modest Fashion, is to bring representation in all areas of media. So I'm working on a film right now. Like I said, in fashion, I feel like the ship is sailing positively. So for me, it's about including positive representation through film and telling our stories.
Maria Idrisi is the first hijab-wearing fashion model to be featured in a global campaign. She's also a speaker on women's empowerment. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In this installment of our series of interviews with Wisconsin candidates for Congress, we speak with Dan Cole. Dan is a lawyer who's been a Milwaukee Bucks executive and a lobbyist for the pro-Israel firm J Street. Cole is the Democratic candidate running to represent Wisconsin's 6th district in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's running against Republican incumbent Glenn Grothman. Dan, welcome to The Morning Show.
It's great to be here, John. Thanks for having me on.
So why are you running for Congress?
I'm running for Congress because we need new leaders who are going to fight for their constituents and put hardworking families ahead of special interests and corporations. I'm running to make sure that every American can have health care that's quality and affordable. I'm running to make sure we protect Medicare and Social Security. I'm very concerned about the consequences of the tax bill that adds $2 trillion to our national debt and puts Medicare and Social Security at risk.
So you're running, you're campaigning on pulling politics back from the extremes. What do you mean by that?
You know what? We see so much division and we see so much polarization. Just, you know, look at what's going on over the last couple days. We need to be focusing on what unites us and not what divides us. And we need elected leaders who are going to be, you know, who are going to try to engage people in dialogue, not focused on differences and accentuate the growing divide that we see in our country.
Okay, well, let's look at that in a practical way then. If you're elected, how will you work with Republican colleagues, given the polarization that we've seen? Are there specific issues you can see yourself working with Republicans on?
I do. You know, infrastructure is one issue. Republicans and Democrats, we can all agree that we have decaying infrastructure system in our country. And, you know, look at the roads in Wisconsin, where we rank right at the bottom in the country. So that's one area we absolutely can and need to work together. Workforce training is another area. Fighting the opioid epidemic is another area of common ground. So you need to sit down, you need to talk, you need to look for areas of agreement. If you don't sit down and talk, you're just not going to get there.
Well, let's talk about health care, because that's something that's on just about everybody's mind in this midterm election. If you're elected, how would you like to change the way health care works in America?
And health care is absolutely on everyone's minds. I don't care where I go in this district, whether I am in Cedarburg or Sheboygan or Manitowoc, Oshkosh, Amaro, it is on everyone's minds. So the bottom line is we live in the wealthiest country in the world, and everyone should have health care that's quality and affordable. We need to make sure that nobody with a pre-existing condition is at risk of losing those protections. That is my baseline. my opponent, he voted to take health insurance away from over 400,000 people in the state. He voted to remove protections for people with pre-existing conditions, to impose an age tax on older Americans where they would pay up to five times in their premiums. So you know what? We need to move forward. We need to lower prices. One thing that I support is allowing Medicare to negotiate to lower the cost of prescription drugs. Another thing that I'm calling for is to allow middle-aged Americans to buy into Medicare.
Okay, so was the Affordable Care Act enough? Are there policy changes beyond that that you'd like to see implemented?
It was a start. So, we need to fix, things that aren't functioning right at the present time. But you know what? That was a start. But I called for some of those other steps I just mentioned, that I think we should allow middle-aged Americans to buy into Medicare. On the drug front, in addition to allowing Medicare to negotiate to lower the cost of prescription drugs, after all, they have 60 million Americans that it covers. We allow the VA and the Department of Defense to do that, to use their bulk purchasing power. So we should move to that right away. I also think that Americans should be able to import drugs from safe countries like Canada. And then one other thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that generic alternatives make their way onto market. We see too many big pharmaceutical companies use their monopoly power to price gouge Americans, prevent them from getting the life-saving treatment that they need, and also from blocking generic alternatives from coming onto market.
We're talking with Dan Cole, who is a Democrat running to represent Wisconsin's 6th District in the United States House of Representatives. Dan, the federal budget deficit is another big issue. It's been projected to grow to $1 trillion by 2020, according to the Congressional Budget Office. What measures would you take to handle this budget deficit problem if elected?
You know, we need to look for cost savings wherever we can. I mean, you have to be fiscally responsible. There is a lot of waste all over the place, including in our military budget. What we need to be fiscally responsible. We saw completely the opposite of that this past year, where we passed a tax bill that is going to, it's going to skyrocket our debt. It's adding $2 trillion to our national debt, and it's putting programs like Medicare and Social Security at risk. So, we need to find a way to balance our military and our domestic spending, and we need to be much more responsible to the way we do that to hardworking families.
Immigration has also been in the news a lot this year. Give us your thoughts on the current White House policy on this issue.
Well, you know what? We're a country of immigrants, and we can have an immigration system where employers get the workers that they need, where we can secure the border, and that's in keeping with who we are as a country. We're a nation of laws. We have to enforce those laws, but we can do this in a way that's responsible, that's respectful, where we don't demonize entire communities. I refuse to accept that we have to choose between separating babies from their parents' arms and securing the border.
Some progressive...
And I would just add, all of this underscores the need for comprehensive and bipartisan immigration reform.
Some progressive Democrats have said that we should do away with ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and replace it with a new reformed agency. What's your stance on that?
No, I think those steps are misguided. I think what we need to do is, we need to make sure that ICE carries out its mission, roots out illegal crime. But, I don't think we should be calling for that right now.
Some Democrats who have advocated for abolishing ICE have pointed to reports of immigrants being sexually assaulted and experiencing medical problems under the agency's watch. How would you like to change the way the agency is run if you're elected?
We need oversight, and we need to make sure that ICE is carrying out its mission. They do a lot of important things in terms of drug smuggling and human trafficking. So I think where policies have gone askew, Congress has an important job in terms of oversight, making sure that ICE sticks to the things that it's assigned to do.
Speaking specifically of the 6th Congressional District now, what do you find as you travel around the district? What is the most important issue in the 6th District right now?
I think health care. As I mentioned before, it is on the top of everyone's minds wherever I am in this big district, and we have 11 counties in the district. My baseline is that every single Wisconsinite, every single American should be able to get health care that's quality and affordable. I will fight to make sure that that happens in Congress. I will fight tooth and nail to make sure that nobody with a pre-existing condition loses their loses the protections that they need. I will fight to drive down the crazy cost of prescription drugs in this country. The second issue is Medicare and Social Security. We need to not view these as entitlements. These are earned benefits people pay into the system for decades and decades with the expectation that Medicare and Social Security will be there. So we need to make good on our promise to the seniors. And then the third thing is we need to fight for an economy that works for hardworking families, not just for corporations, not just the very wealthiest.
So as a congressman from Wisconsin, what can you do as one member of Congress to advocate for those things in your district?
You need to hold your ground and fight for those changes. It's something that I will do. You need to look for opportunities where we can to work across the aisle. You need to be somebody who is there for your constituents, that listens, that understands what's on people's minds. I will do all those things in Congress.
Okay. What do you most want voters to know about you as they head to the polls shortly here?
So, you know what? I want people to know that I am somebody who thinks hard. I'm a thoughtful person. I like diving pretty deeply into public policy. I have a family. So my wife is Stacy. We've been married for 27 years. We have 3 kids, Samantha, Ben, and Adam. They're 24, 21, and 19. I grew up in Wisconsin's 6th District. Stacy and I, we raised our kids here. And then the other things that people should know about me that I haven't talked about before is I am not taking a single dime from corporate PACs in this campaign. I will be accountable only to my constituents, not to big corporations. I am also running on a pledge not to serve more than 8 years. I think we have so much fighting and dysfunction in Washington. We have too many elected representatives who take their marching orders from their party leaders. We need change.
Okay. Dan Cole, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
It's great being on with you, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Dan Cole is a lawyer who has been a Milwaukee Bucks executive and a lobbyist for the pro-Israel firm J Street. He's a Democratic candidate running to represent Wisconsin's 6th District in the United States House of Representatives. He's running against Republican incumbent Glenn Grothman. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.